The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning. It is 10 a.m. Saturday, and that means that it is time for your weekly dose of Nature Nuggets here on Radio Kingston. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and I am delighted to be with you all on the air this morning. And I got to studio a little bit early this morning, and so I got to hear the second half of the previous program out in the valley, and just wanted to give some props and thanks to the LGBTQ plus community center. So great that they are celebrating their 20th year this year, just bringing so many important resources to our community. And certainly in these regressive cultural times, their work is more important than ever. And so with that, I'm going to switch gears. And actually, one of the reasons I created this program is because I spend my professional life and my personal life, much of it, as an activist and pushing back and, against the kind of things we're seeing, happening in the world and the government today. I am fighting for human rights and for an end to deforestation, corporate power, these kind of things. So this show was created almost as sort of an antidote to the deluge of darkness that can be just the news feed these days. And so what we do on this program every week is celebrate and explore the incredible biodiversity and ecosystems that we're so lucky to have around us here, from the tidal estuary of the Hudson River up to the high peaks of the Catskills. And right here in Midtown Kingston, even, we have so much delightful ecology, so many incredible creatures. And by bringing people in, so what I do every week is find scientists, artists, authors, educators, people who have developed a level of expertise in some area of the natural world. And I asked them to come on air with us and share some of their insights and experiences, with the idea being that hopefully over time, listeners can maybe gain a little bit deeper of an understanding of something they might see when you go outside. And one of the things I say every week, because, again, was a motivator for doing this program in the beginning, is that people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So with that, I'm going to pivot to our weekly section that we start every show with called Who's About Town. And Who's About Town is sort of like the society pages of a newspaper, but it's for the more than human world. And one of my favorite scientific terms is phenology, which is essentially the study of the progression of the seasons. And there is not a time of year that's probably more exciting for observing that particular phenomenon than spring, especially early spring. And so we are seeing a just delightful emergence happening all around. I saw the daffodils are starting to poke up right here at my house in Midtown Kingston when I came out this morning. And my partner is actually heading down to the city today and showed me the forecast is for 80 degrees in New York City today, which, you know, is 15 degrees or so more than here. But that is, it's crazy, really, but it is a turning point. And so let's see. Right after this program last week, we got on our bikes, had to put air in the tire because they'd been down in the basement, all winter. And we took off and did a trip down all the way to Rosendale on the Wallkill Valley Rail Trail, which is so cool. You can access it right from, Midtown Kingston and then get on it. And it's just sort of a flat ride through the woods all the way to Rosendale and, of course, beyond. But it's amazing. It's interesting how much of that landscape between Kingston and Rosendale is really swampy. And so we drove through a lot of swampy areas. And March, maybe the most exciting thing about spring happening in March is that the amphibians are on the move. So the spotted, the salamanders, the spring peepers, the frogs, everybody has come out and is getting busy. And so we pulled over and into a little kind of swampy area and pulled out a stick that had a gelatinous mass of transparent eggs attached to it, kind of a almost like a baseball size mass. And I would have thought they were frogs, but we pulled out the trusty Seek app, which is the free app connected to iNaturalist, and it said that they were mole salamanders, which I had never heard of, and but realized that that is a whole category of salamanders. It's a family of them that includes spotted salamanders. And we were able, I posted the photo onto our Hudson Valley Nature Nuggets Instagram, and some of the folks who follow us there were able to tag herp experts and definitively say that, in fact, they were spotted salamander eggs. So that was a very cool observation to find. And spotted salamander, if you can't picture one, is a big, chunky, shiny, black salamander with sort of yellow polka dots. And they look very kind of cartoonish, and they're very cool to see. Let's see, along that same section, we saw the first flowers of spring that I've seen. I have mentioned a couple weeks now about skunk cabbage, and so their stinky purple flowers were coming up out of the muck, and they're just so crazy because, of course, they're a plant that's actually able to practice thermogenesis. They can pull in oxygen and break apart the bonds and create heat, and so even if it's snow, they can melt right through it in the early spring. So they were out and about. With their stinky flowers. And then there was another all along the trail, this brilliant electric yellow little flower called coltsfoot, which sort of comes up just the flower with those, you know, no leaves around it. And then the last one I'll mention down there that's happening right now was this other very cheerful, bright, bright yellow little flower called a swamp marigold. And so those are all in bloom right here on the outskirts of town right now. And even in town, down at the Kingston Point Park this last week, I saw that some of the red maples are in full bloom. They've got that cool kind of, you might not even recognize them as flowers at first, but they're sort of starburst red flowers at the tips of their branches. And even the pond turtles are out. We saw, I also saw some pond turtles, so that's cool. So I'll do a proper introduction of today's guest, Dr. Zion Kloss, in a moment. But before we leave this Who's About Town section, Zion, thank you for being here in the studio.
Thanks for having me here today.
And I wanted to ask, I know that you're out and about and you're a nature observer, and I'm curious, what are some of your things that you're seeing when you're heading out into the field these days?
Yeah, so I was out, great to mention vernal pools. I was out on a trail run and finally noticed that we were ice-free everywhere. And yeah, the ice stuck around much longer than it had in previous years. With our La Nina this year out in the Pacific Ocean, we've had a much colder winter for the last couple months than we've had in the last few years. And I do a lot of work with vernal pools with my students, and just seeing that ice last so long was such a different thing this year. And I work with some herpetologists, and we're seeing that everything is delayed this year, which might actually be a good thing, because one of the big challenges is by the end of summer, those pools drying out before the tadpoles can fully mature into adults. So it might be a good thing for their populations. Another exciting thing I saw, I was out with my students on a burn site over by the Blue Hole in the Catskills. It burned last November, but it was just a low severity burn. So just the understory of the forest. But we got out there and you could see how all that leaf litter was taken away and logs were charred, but the trees were still there and a lot of green tiny things were popping up all over the place. And students got to kind of see what that looks like in contrast to, you know, the hill slope right next to it that hadn't been burned, which was still very much a dry and brown space. So seeing how a fire can really rejuvenate a landscape. So
wow, that's cool. And I'm glad to hear that it is official, that it actually has been taking longer. I was thinking I was just being impatient.
Because it does
seem like, come on. We really are at that cusp right now where it's undeniably spring, and astronomically it is officially been more than a week that it's spring. But, you know, we don't really have leaves on the trees yet. The real colorful tropical birds haven't arrived yet. But it's happening. And I know that one big milestone is that this last week, I think the first, you know, there's a number of bald eagle nests, including one in the town of Poughkeepsie, and then up and down the Hudson River, that have, they're observed. Some of them have cameras on them, and others just have people who regularly go and visit. But this last week was the first hatchlings. So the gestation, you know, period with on the eggs has concluded, and they can tell this because the bald eagles, they won't bring prey to the nest until there's a mouth to feed there, because otherwise, you know, raccoons could attract raccoons and stuff. So the fact that they're bringing rodents and fish to the nest means that there are little eaglets, and that's pretty cool. I also wanted to let folks know that the eels are coming. They have started the glass eels, which is, you know, just an incredible thing to participate in because they're almost impossible to find if you just go out on your own. They're largely nocturnal, they're clear, they live in the mud. But if you go out with the Department of Environmental Conservation or Scenic Hudson as a volunteer, you can go, they have specialized traps in places like Black Creek. It's a really neat experience to see these very unique, very strange creatures that have just traveled all the way from the Bermuda Triangle, you know, up to, you know, the creeks and rivers of the Hudson watershed. So if you're interested in having that experience, it's a great thing to take kids to, and you can go to the Scenic Hudson's volunteer page, I believe has all the details there. You can also Google the DEC eels and you'll get to it. But I would encourage folks, if you haven't had that experience, to check that out. And I was going to share one other sort of what nature nugget. And, you know, we're starting to see this is the time of year where our resident birds who have didn't leave for the winter have a bit of an advantage getting started right with the nesting season because, well, they didn't have to expend all that energy flying thousands of miles and shrinking their organs and, you know, having to adjust. So they were able to start the process of nest building earlier and in the season. So we're starting to see that happening, and especially like some of our early arrivals, like Eastern Phoebes, because they're a short distant migrant, they get that advantage. But I saw this as an interesting note, and I've seen this before, about the use of snake skins in bird nests, and I thought that was pretty cool. And so I looked it up, and I found a study that was published just this last year in the American Naturalist magazine, and our journal, probably. And so it says that the behavior, which is not previously been well understood, has been found to be more prevalent in cavity nesting species compared to those that build open cup nests. So, you know, cavity nesters are things like, you know, bluebirds and nuthatches, chickadees, all kinds of different species are use old woodpecker holes or they'll use boxes if they have them provided for them. And but they found that the snake skin are more commonly found inside these cavities. And so these birds, you know, have to go to probably quite great lengths to go searching the forest floor for snake skin and then to incorporate it into their nest. And so the study supports the hypothesis that snake skin helps deter predators. And so they think that they did all these studies using artificial nests with and without snake skin, and then having, you know, small predators like flying squirrels and other mammals. And they found that the presence of snake skins can act as a deterrent and could increase the survival rate of eggs in nests that have them. And the thinking behind it is that there's a strong evolutionary association for these little predators that the smell of snakes is dangerous. And so they can be put off by the smell. So I just thought that was great. It's one of those, highly complex strategies that, you know, a bird is employing, really brilliant, you know, to protect their offspring. And it's exactly one of those kind of things that, you know, it just takes someone looking close enough and long enough to pick up a pattern and then make a hypothesis and study it and then, you know, gain that like deeper insight into something that is happening around us all the time. And those kind of things are endless. All right. I think maybe I make call that a wrap for our Who's About Town. And I'm going to more properly introduce today's guest. Dr. Zion Kloss is a professor of environmental science and now the department chair at Marist University. That's official, right? University?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is indeed. We changed our name from college to university.
Yeah, so. Okay. I just realized as I said it, I think that I don't know if I've said the term Marist University out loud before. Well, all right. You are a university professor. And so I'm going to read, I changed Zion's bio from the first person into the third person. So hopefully he's not embarrassed, but I'm going to, I think this is a good capture. Zion's work is so wide ranging and dynamic and integrative that I think this captures a bit of that. And then we'll hear it from him himself. But as an environmental earth scientist, Zion focuses on integrating the physical, ecological, and social sciences, often through the lens of issues surrounding water and climate. Before Marist, he was based at the University of California, Santa Barbara, while pursuing research focused on the overlap of ecohydrology, geology, and land management in mountain systems. So a bunch to unpack there. And this work stemmed from doctoral research at the University of Idaho, focused on the interaction of water, ecology, and society in the western U.S., Costa Rica, and on the eastern seaboard via a year on a sailboat. There, he specialized in physical hydrology and climate science, but was also part of a unique team-based PhD focused on using a psychological lens to communicate and evaluate how changes in climate were impacting decision-making in resource-dependent communities. And Zion's foundational interests in the physical sciences stem from his undergraduate major in geology at Colorado College, and it was there that he fostered another major personal passion and interest in outdoor leadership. And so at Marist, he brings these types of transformative, outdoor-based, project-focused research and course experiences to his students to help them better understand the natural world and its integration with society, both locally and globally. All right, that was a lot, but that's really exciting. So just to kick off straight from there, how did you get here? Were you always interested in nature? Was there spark experiences when you were young that you did in environmental education?
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate to have parents that were very engaged with the outdoors. Their honeymoon was a backpacking trip in Glacier National Park back in the 70s. I grew up in Wisconsin on a farm, so it's outside all the time as a child, working with animals, just exploring around. My dad was stay-at-home farm dad. My mom also had an office job, and we kind of just were watched by the dog, and me and my sister would play around, and the dog would make sure we didn't go on the highway, and we just kind of explored nature all around us all day long outside, and just really got to love being in the outdoors, always being able to go somewhere new and see something new, and just really becoming passionate about observation and then trying to understand why the things are doing the things, why things are the way they are in the outdoors. And that's just been a core part of my life since as long as I can ever remember, my first memories. In middle school, I really got to dive into what it means to live in a more adventurous outdoor setting. My dad's dream was to sail around the world. So my mom quit her job. We sold the animals. We bought an old wooden sailboat, spent a year fixing it up, and then sailed for 2 years as a family. We didn't make it around the world, but we did down the Mississippi, through the Caribbean, up the East Coast. Saw Kingston and Poughkeepsie for the first time in middle school as we were making our way up towards the Erie Canal.
Oh, wow.
And then back through the Great Lakes. And that was like a big family adventure. And it was really a coming of age for both me and my sister. We were both in middle school. We were capable of doing a lot to help, getting the boat through storms in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, or being out there and trying to figure out, it's the middle of the night and the anchor's dragging. What are we going to do? Waking up in a kind of emergency situation. So we're like really building confidence in these kind of like adventurous outdoor settings. And then that kind of set the stage for getting back to my kind of hometown in Wisconsin. Realized I was kind of had a different experience than a lot of my friends. So I actually sought to go somewhere else for high school. And I was very fortunate. There was a brand new environmentally focused high school that was like a boarding school up in northern Wisconsin called Conserve School. It was brand new, and they were bringing students in for free. If you could get into the school, and there were students from all over the country and international students, and the whole school had an environmental outdoor focus in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, which is a lot like the Adirondacks minus the mountains. So just like lakes and forest. And that really just got me full throttle into outdoor adventure in terms of, you know, kayaking, camping, mountain biking, doing all these things that I loved for recreation. But then also, how do we lead people into this space? How do we get people experiencing this for the first time that are new? And then really understanding what that means for how we get people to care about the environment. And then at the same time, doing a ton of science courses all around natural sciences and human dimensions of environmental thought. And I really got this great kind of environmental science, environmental studies education in that kind of high school years. And then that kind of set the stage for thinking, okay, how do I specialize in certain areas I'm most passionate about, which got me into the kind of the earth sciences, then eventually into hydrology and climate. And then into back to this kind of integrative framework that I use now here at Marist University. And so that's been my kind of bigger narrative arc that you've also kind of walked through in that introduction there.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that with us. Well, it's so like wonderful that you've played forward the opportunities that you were given as a young person, you know, and I also believe that, you know, outdoor experiential education is just about the most important thing in the, you know, in the world today. It's absolutely transformative, and so many people, you know, they've named nature deficit syndrome as a real thing, and just so many young people growing up have a fear or just a lack of knowing about the natural world. And of course, it doesn't work out for anybody, because it's bad for people, bad for our mental health and our physical health, and of course, it's bad for the natural world, because people, as we say in the opening, you know, won't fight for what they don't love and can't love what they don't know. And so I'm so glad that, you know, I'm interested to hear a little bit more sort of about, you know, I know a lot of what you do is very academic, but also experiential, and getting young people out physically outside, touching the ground, digging in the dirt, that kind of a thing. And curious to hear just some of your sort of observations of and insights of the ways that students react, you know, to that kind of experience differently than like a classroom setting.
Yeah, I find that there's a lot of students who are very capable in the classroom, but aren't super engaged, and they kind of find it difficult to fully, you know, motivate themselves into that academic space. But then those students who take into the outdoors, and all of a sudden they just turn on in ways that you do not see in the classroom. There are plenty of students who are very active in both spaces too, but I do find that for some of those students that haven't really found their place in an academic setting before, that this outdoor space really can activate them and get them excited. And I also find that it's really good, even if they're not intrinsically interested in what they thought of as outdoor skills or environmental knowledge, they all of a sudden see themselves in a very novel space. And that novel challenge, a lot of them kind of fear at first, but then all of a sudden see that we're a group, we're doing it together, a bunch of us are doing this for the first time. I'm helping foster that kind of introductory space. And then they come out of that with so much more self-confidence in knowing that, oh, hey, I just did something very out of my comfort zone. I worked through that. It was challenging. I was cold. I was wet. But I had a lot of fun. We did it together. And now I know I can push myself into new places. And when you're a young person, having those type of experiences is really transformative for just building your general self-confidence and where you can take yourself into the future. So.
Yeah, I don't know what I've always thought that there's a window between, like, yeah, the teens and maybe into mid-20s or something where, you know, it can be absolutely life transformative. It was for me, you know, to have those kinds of experiences. And so I know you've done all kinds of things. You've brought, you know, students out to the, you know, wilderness of Alaska, but also, you know, more, you know, closely around here, of course. You just mentioned being down at Blue Hole this week. But yeah, I'm curious, like, what does that look like? What are some of the experiences that your students are having outside?
Yeah, so we, I think a good example, we did this Alaska course last, we do like a May term where we can go abroad for an extended period. And went up to work with a partner institution, the Tidelines Institute, in Glacier Bay National Park, or on the edge of it. And we kind of got up there and immediately got into camping and then got sea kayaks packed and headed off into the backcountry for a week. And every day seeing hundreds of marine mammals. We had a very intimate orca whale pod experiences in this cove that we were in, all around us, coming up, herding a school of fish for half an hour. We see grizzlies, black bears, massive glaciers, and, you know, huge cliffs, and also 40 degrees Fahrenheit and raining for a good portion of it. And working through those challenges at the same time we have all this excitement going on and trying to, and, you know, and bringing in all these academic components as well to talk about the greater ecosystem as well as the society from a historic perspective and thinking about indigenous people and what their background was like. And they're still a massive part of thinking about how do we manage landscapes today as a combined community of people who have been here for thousands of years and people who are newer to the area and the federal government and the local governments and the local groups, and being able to talk about all those complexities with the students while we're in those spaces, meeting with people that can come out to us or finding our way to them, meeting with fishermen, meeting with people from the Federal Park Service, meeting with local activists to like get all these different perspectives on what does it mean to be part of this community that's so integrated with the environment. And then at the same time, comparing and contrasting it back to the Hudson Valley here. We had done a backpacking trip in the Hudson Valley this few months before that. And I do this course every year, so we're about to do that again. And in that space, we kind of take those same interdisciplinary lens and look at the Hudson Valley. And in a lot of ways for the students, put the kind of suburban upbringing that a lot of Americans have and put it into this greater kind of theoretical context so that we can then compare and contrast it to some other place in the world where the communities are much more interwoven with their local environment in ways that sometimes we get much more removed from in this kind of very, very structured, very kind of homogenous suburban classic upbringing space that a lot of us, you know, have, because it's just the, you know, it's what's practical when you have this many people trying to live on the on the world. But yeah, so that's a really fun way to teach.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, what an incredible opportunity, that the level of learning that you have when you're just outside, you know, all day long, and the combination of adrenaline and new experiences and the way that information absorbs and sticks, you know, it cannot be compared to the classrooms. I really look forward to continuing this conversation, which we are going to do after we take a quick break to hear some words from the community.
Hi, I'm Kristen Kessler from the City of Kingston's Department of Health and Wellness. We'd like to invite you to Kingston Eats, the citywide Harvest of the Month campaign, where celebrating healthy, local food is fun. This year, we're focusing on the abundance that is grown near us in the Hudson Valley. Look for upcoming Harvest of the Months like potatoes, beans, asparagus, and more. As always, there will be menu specials at local restaurants, free produce at participating local food pantries, free cooking workshops, and fun school-based and daycare activities for our youngest community members. If you can't make it out to a special event, you can also find Kingston Eats online on Facebook and Instagram at LiveWellKingston and using the hashtag KingstonEatsFresh. You can get more information on participating locations when you click Eat Well at livewellkingston.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Godby. Join me Monday nights at 9 for Kingston Happenings. I'll help you stay informed about upcoming events, new businesses, initiatives from local nonprofits, and much more. I'll be chatting with movers, shakers, doers, and dreamers, the interesting people and personalities that are making things happen in our community, always with great music from local musicians. Kingston Happenings is the radio extension of my website that tells you about everything that's going on in the Kingston area, kingstonhappenings.org. Kingston Happenings, Monday nights at 9 p.m., here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, and anytime on radiokingston.org.
The Ulster County Chamber of Commerce is accepting nominations for the 2025 Black Business Awards, now through Tuesday, April 1st. These awards recognize Ulster County's Black business leaders and Black-owned businesses that have demonstrated commitment, community spirit, philanthropy, or have achieved extraordinary accomplishments. Community members have the opportunity to nominate a Black business leader, Black-owned business, or organization for these honors. Nominations must be submitted no later than 5 p.m. Tuesday, April 1st. These awards will be given at the 2025 Black Business Community Celebration, which is Wednesday, June 18th at Ulster Savings Bank. To nominate a person or organization, or for more information, visit ulsterchamber.org. Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we are speaking today with Dr. Zion Kloss, who's a professor of environmental science and department chair now at Marist University. And I just want to say, first of all, also remind folks, if you are just catching a piece of this conversation and you want to hear the whole thing, this episode will be archived, like all of our episodes are. It'll be up on radiokingston.org under the Nature Nuggets show. And you can also follow us if you're interested on Instagram. Our handle is at HVNatureNuggets. And then lastly, if you want to contact us directly, we have an email, naturenuggets@radiokingston.org. If you have somebody you think would be a good guest for the show, or a nature question that you can't find the answer to, maybe we can help. So you can reach out to us directly. Awesome. Well, Zion, you know, you were just giving us kind of a dazzling description of some of the offerings and some of the amazing experiences that your students, you know, have been able to have in your courses, from local field trips all the way to, you know, backcountry Alaska wilderness immersion. And I wanted to, you know, pull on some of the elements that were in your bio that I read, because you are a scientist and have studied physical sciences and in very academic sort of settings, and especially, interestingly, hydrology and climate science. But there's also a, you know, you mentioned, you know, using a psychological lens, and in other places you talk about the intersections of society with that work. And so I was hoping to ask you to talk a little bit more about how those kind of hard science, academia interacts with actually in the real world, and how we communicate about the environment.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, correct. My core knowledge is in the natural sciences, but I've done a lot in the social sciences and psychological sciences as well. And I really find that in the natural sciences, we can work hard to understand what's going on out there and study it. And I just love the intrinsically love the complexity of it and understanding new processes and how pieces relate to each other. But in the end of the day, if we aren't actually save these ecosystems that are under so much threat right now from climate change and other human human impacts, it doesn't matter how much you understand them if people don't take action to do something. And a big part of my PhD was a variety of graduate courses in psychology and kind of conservation social sciences. So how do we think about using social sciences to help with conservation goals? And one of the big takeaways, and you know, from kind of the psychological world, is that in the end of the day, when we make decisions as humans, it's actually less about a logical decision and it's much more about an intuitive decision. And that's just the reality of, you know, the thousands of micro decisions we need to make in every moment. We don't have to think through them all. We just make a decision and move ahead. Some of the larger decisions we make in our lives, we try to, I think, post hoc rationalize why we made it one way or the other. And if we're really good at that, we might decide to convince ourselves from what our initial intuitive thought was. But at our core, we're making these intuitive decisions. And as a academic and teaching in this kind of very rational scientific space, we're so used to just taking that fully rational lens and using that to try to justify everything. But if you don't take into account that people are making these decisions from an intuitive side at the core, then you're really often going to miss the opportunity to reach people if you can find a way to also hit them in that kind of with that intuitive messaging or that intuitive kind of emotional space. And so that was part of my PhD. The last year and a half was on a sailboat again. The same boat fixed back up after 15 years kind of rotting away in the backyard of the farm, and partnering up with an artist doing this climate odyssey project where I worked with communities from right here in the Hudson Valley along the Hudson River all the way down to the tropics along the East Coast. seeing if we can use art as a way to engage people with climate science, for that same exact reason. Like, can we get an intuitive, emotional space created where someone is engaging with the nature and the things they care about around them to create a connection, which is so much and so great to see the show that you have here about how do we really become passionate about this natural space around us. And then once we have that passion, we're much more likely to act on the new knowledge that we've gained from in that space. And that's where the outdoor leadership, outdoor education has been such a core part of my environmental ethos as well, because I feel like I'm very skilled at getting people into the outdoors for the first time. And if we can create a space where they start seeing the outdoors instead of it being an uncomfortable, cold, rainy, or too hot of space, where they want to be in a more controlled indoor space as their preference, to actually figure out ways to enjoy it by having the right type of introductory experiences and understanding how to dress appropriately and so on and so forth, then they start really spending time there and they start becoming passionate about all the things we see around us, which is what this show is all about. And once you start having that passion, then when the message comes about, hey, we need to do this action, or we need to invest our time or money in this particular thing to save this particular issue, you're going to be much more likely to be in support of that, should you have that connection. So that's really at the core of what I think I'm trying to do as an educator and as a kind of environmental activist in that way. So.
Oh, that was very well put. And obviously, I dearly love the sentiment that you're expressing there, and think that, yeah, I mean, I think the central theme of this show has sort of been the, you know, the delusion of a separation between humans and nature, and it doesn't work out well for anybody, you know, and so, you know, here, and, you know, we live in this urban environment, and increasingly more and more people in this country and around the world do, but we also are nature, and everywhere we go is nature. And the more people can realize that and feel like a, you know, not just an analytical approach to it, but a kinship and intimacy, then exactly, then they're going to make different decisions and lead different lives. And so the kind of opportunities you're talking about providing for people is break, you know, is where those kind of breakthroughs happen. It's so great. There's so many different things I want to talk about. And maybe we'll come back a little bit to some of the outdoor education parts, but I want to make sure that we don't lose talking about beavers, because I know that you have studied, in addition to just hydrology, have studied some of nature's original hydrologists.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear, you know, beavers are such a prominent and fascinating part of the overall ecosystems that we're surrounded with here. And I'd love to hear about your, you know, your studying of the beavers.
Yeah. And actually, it doesn't seem that different than what I was just talking about, because actually where this beaver, I just chose this as an example of the type of research I'm doing right now. There's a lot of other projects outside of beaver related work as well that I'm working on, but they all are community driven student projects. So at Marist University, what we really want to prioritize for research with faculty is that research happens through undergraduate experiences, so that our students can get this type of experience before they move on to understand if they maybe want to go to grad school or not in the sciences. And so they get this kind of pre-graduate school experience through this undergraduate research. And so that's a huge focus of my time outside of teaching courses. And one of the projects has been focused on beaver, because all my projects relate to water in some way. And as a hydrologist, that's at the core of what hydrology is, the study of how water moves through the environment, how it shapes the environment, how it is being controlled by the environment, how we have risks from flooding or from drought and things that are really tied to human existence through water. And I try to make every one of those student projects community engaged. And what I mean by that is I serve on a variety of boards throughout the Hudson Valley. And I am off at two or three meetings a week where I'm learning about issues that groups are having, and seeing how, wait, there's some new knowledge that's needed here. And that's what research is all about, creating new knowledge. And if I can create new knowledge that also can help with a particular issue in the community, that win-win really motivates students, just like they're motivated to be outside once they start to really appreciate it and start to try to protect the environment after that appreciation. They also intrinsically, especially in my environmental students, have this just strong passion for helping others and trying to make this world a better place. So this community engaged research really motivates them to go for it. And one example of that is this beaver research I've been part of the last few years. We've seen beaver move into this region, this kind of these suburban watersheds where you have a lot of houses, forest, all the way down through like Westchester County to the south, just seeing in the last decade a big expansion of beaver into this space. And people don't know quite how to manage that and how to deal with that, because they are very much very industrious members of our ecosystem, and they move water around and they dam it up and they block culverts and block water intake pipes for communities that need that water for drinking, and they flood people's basements and backyards and so on and so forth. And so there's been a lot of community need around that particular issue. And I intrinsically just love beaver. Like I mentioned, I started my environmental education in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, and canoe camping trips were the big thing we did up there, just like the Adirondacks. And beaver were a part of my life day to day, and you're seeing beaver constantly and all the things they're building and how much they're changing the landscapes. And then I ended up, like you mentioned, in Idaho for my PhD, and there I had this just like transformative beaver experience. And it's one that didn't actually involve any live beavers, but I was doing geophysical research, which is how we Earth sciences, it's how do we understand what's happening in the subsurface without seeing it directly? We kind of joke that it's a dark art of the earth sciences, but we use like electromagnetic waves, or we use seismic waves or magnetic signatures to image the subsurface to try to see what's happening below our feet. It's really hard to know, but there's a lot of complexity down there, and it really matters for water storage and how trees are going to survive or not in drought, or how much water is going to be in our streams during dry seasons. And I was doing this work in the Owyhee Mountains in Southwest Idaho. And this project, we were trying to understand why certain groves of aspen were growing in certain places and not others. And it seemed like it had something to do with these big accumulations of kind of good loam, like a nice soil for growing in, versus really rocky sections. And there's the kind of background geomorphology of why material on the Earth's surface erodes in certain places and accumulates in others. But this doesn't really fit the story. And we're confused. Like, why is there so much accumulation of really nice soils right here and not over there in ways that don't quite make sense? And so we got out this geophysical equipment, imaging the subsurface, and you start seeing down 20, 30 feet below your feet that there are massive logs that have been aligned down there. You know, they're looking at trees that are a foot across and 20, 30 feet long. And we start piecing together this idea that this might be a massive dam structure below our feet that's been buried for thousands of years. And you start thinking, oh, wait, what was here 1,000 years ago? Well, prehistoric beaver that went extinct with the other megafauna at the end of the last ice age, when people expanded throughout North America here and around the world. There were beavers the size of Volkswagen bugs moving across the landscape, taking down trees, building much larger structures than we see today. And that realization that, oh, this whole landscape today is still controlled by what these beavers did 10,000 years ago was just a mind bending thought process of, you know, wow, these are some huge parts of understanding how our landscapes operate. Beaver are really at the core of that. And that excitement kind of continued when I started hearing about all these beaver concerns here in the Hudson Valley when I came out here with the move to Marist University. And what we're doing here now is we are working with the Fallkill Watershed Coalition, which is I help lead that over in Poughkeepsie. We have the Hudson River Watershed Association, which is our Watershed Alliance, which is a larger group of watershed coalitions all over the Hudson Valley that's led here out of Kingston. And these beaver questions keep coming up and up. And I said, hey, I have some students looking for projects. I pitch these ideas to them. Is this something you're interested in? And of course, I think most people would be like, yeah, beaver sounds really cool. Let's do some beaver stuff. And so I started looking at previous research around how are these dams operating in terms of biogeochemical cycling. And what we mean by biogeochemical cycling is how does the biologic processes, the beaver, all the plants that grow in these beaver ponds that are built, how do they help all the bacteria that are in there, how do they help kind of digest some of the pollutants we're seeing in our watershed? And one of the big pollutant issues we have is excess nutrients. Mm-hmm. We think of nutrients as good things, but too much is really an issue, especially in waterways. And we have a lot of excess because we have a lot of high density of septic systems all over the Hudson Valley because we just have a lot of people in a kind of distributed way, this kind of forested suburban space. And these septic systems are they might be good for treating some of the most harmful pieces. And if they are operating correctly, they should treat all of the excess nutrients, but they don't always. And we have a bedrock that helps some of that water move rather quickly into streams. And so we have these excess nutrients in there and they make their way downstream. There might be golf courses or farm fields as well, or backyard lawns that we're putting in excess nutrients on for fertilizer. So all these nutrients are making their way downstream and they get stopped in these beaver dams. And we're curious, how are these beaver dams operating to digest those? Do they help? Or do they actually maybe even make it potentially worse because they're creating a space for kind of warm water to accumulate where it would otherwise be pretty cold because it's interacting with the groundwater a lot more. So we have this kind of stratified water that forms in a pond that could then provide a space where different types of algal communities like cyanobacteria, which like blue-green algae, could grow and then lead to like harmful algal blooms there, potentially downstream. So there's just a lot of unknowns, and it's a great space for research then, right? As we kind of do this new overlap of suburban, highly populated areas with beaver, which is kind of happening for the first time here in this region. And that's the first time, there's not a lot of research on that around the world. So it's a great thing to be doing research on. We're advancing new knowledge, but we're also helping people at the same time. And so we did a first year's project, really trying to understand how much water is moving above or below the ground, partnered with Dion Knight, who's a professor at Vassar, who's a specialist in biogeochemical processing and a hydrologist as well. And him and I and our students kind of set up a variety of projects on some beaver ponds they had on their property. And then my students went out to additional beaver ponds throughout the Hudson Valley, setting up long-term sites with community partners. A lot of landowners were very happy to be like, oh, I have beaver. I'm curious what's going on. A lot of friendly people happy to have that going on in their backyard. We basically found that, we think these beaver dams are definitely changing how nutrients are being processed. And one of the actual kind of pieces that got tricky for us is we actually saw that during dry periods, like between storm events, in the summer we usually get a big storm about once a week, but sometimes we'll go 2 or 3 weeks and we kind of get into like a mini drought. And when that happens, we start seeing some of the phosphorus levels, and phosphorus and nitrogen are our two elements that we're most worried about in terms of excess nutrients. We see the phosphorus levels really spike in these ponds. And that's a bit scary because during those dry periods is usually the hottest periods as well. And during the hot summer periods is when you have the biggest risk of harmful algal blooms in downstream areas. We're starting to see more and more of those in the Hudson River proper. They've already been happening for years in a lot of our lakes in the area. And if you're not familiar with those, the shorthand, we call them HABs, H-A-Bs, but they are from cyanobacteria of certain types, or they can be from any type of algal community, but the ones we're particularly concerned about are some of these cyanobacteria blooms. This blue-green algae is their other name, and they can have neurotoxins in some types of them, not all of them. And that can be harmful to humans. We hear about it a lot with our, keep your dogs out of the water, because if they lick off the algae that they accumulated, that can kill them. So we want to really avoid just having harmful algal blooms in general, but we want to figure out how do we prevent them. And this beaver part was an interesting part of the question. Like, are we seeing this unusual spike in phosphorus in these dams for reasons that we can explain? And it's particularly happening at a very concerning time. We don't want a lot of excess phosphorus during the warmest moments of the summer. And took this research to an international conference, happened in San Francisco this last year, the big American Geophysical Union, but international researchers, about 30,000 around the world, that do all types of hydrology and earth sciences, climate science. And a researcher from California stopped by the poster that the student had, and me and Dion were there too. And we were all chatting, and that's the great thing about these poster sessions. We're just idea generating. They said, hey, we have this beaver research we're doing out in California, and we're actually seeing that during dry periods, they're really actively digging. They're going out there, and we have these cameras out, and we're seeing them dig because they have a lot of side channels, and they have a lot of need to, as the water levels drop, they start seeing places they can put patch more and get mud into new places on their dams. And they have these side channels that get them from the main pond through the kind of boundary wetlands around their pond to the hard shore where all the trees are growing. And they need to dig those channels deeper because that's how they float logs out to their pond, or float sticks and things that they're going to, so a lot of it they put down deep in store for the winter for food. And they want to stay underneath the water for protection from predators too. So we think they're actually like digging a lot during these periods where the water is starting to dry down. And from a biogeochemical perspective, a lot of this phosphorus is actually bound to the sediment, the organic sediment on the bottom. So by stirring it up, you potentially could release a bunch of phosphorus. So this is the hypothesis we now have formed through this conversation with other beaver related hydrology researchers. And then that formed this year's project, where I'm partnering with we just hired a new urban wildlife ecologist at Marist, Dr. Kate Weiss, and she specializes in camera trapping, but with like terrestrial animals on the land, a lot with like urban carnivores. Worked a lot with puma out in Arizona during her PhD, and now she's working with foxes and coyote, but also everything else here in the Hudson Valley, since at Marist we get to wear a lot of hats and be really interdisciplinary with our work. And so her and I, with a group of students now who are excited about the project, are going out and putting camera traps on all these beaver sites to see, okay, can we actually observe during dry periods this digging behavior? Because actually their butts come out of the water and you can see them digging because it's shallow where they're digging, and you can actually observe it in these videos, or so we hope. Yeah. And so that's kind of where we're at right now with the current project, is can we now answer this question of, are beaver digging in a way that releases this phosphorus that might be then giving us a threat? And if we can show that that's a reality, then we might think about, is there potential management strategies we could have to help, you know, maybe we go in and artificially dig some of the stuff deeper for them ahead of time, or we know if we have some high risk areas that we maybe manage for beaver more in those particular spaces. There's a lot of structures we can build into beaver dams where they can still stay there, but we can control the water level, these kind of beaver deceiver structures that are essentially pipes with these big cages around, and they deceive the beavers from where the water is actually making its way in and out of their ponds. So, yeah.
Fascinating. Well, beavers are so amazing. I mean, they're just incredible, and I'm heartened a bit to know they seem to be having a bit of a cultural moment. First started working, you know, to beaver-related issues, you know, years and years ago in the West Coast, and, you know, they were still officially considered to be a varmint, you know, a pest, you know, by the government wildlife agencies. But more and more, it seems like they're being put back into landscapes intentionally. And also, I know that I think the first beavers were just returned to the UK for the first time in hundreds of years. So, we're going to take one more quick break to hear some more words from our community, and then we will be back to wrap up the show.
Hi, I'm Daniel Woodham from the Ulster Immigrant Defense Network. We've been hearing a lot about knowing your rights lately. It means all people living in this country, including immigrants, have basic rights granted by the U.S. Constitution. Here's how to protect yourself at home. If anyone you suspect is ICE comes to your door, don't let them in. Ask to see an ID and a warrant signed by a judge. Have them slip it under the door or show it in the window, but don't open the door. ICE is counting on you not knowing that they need a judicial warrant to enter your home. Show them that you know your rights. If ICE doesn't have a warrant signed by a judge, you can say, "I do not want to speak to you. Please leave." There are also Know Your Rights workshops and presentations in the community for immigrants and their allies. To get information on the workshops, click Know Your Rights at ulsterimmigrantdefensenetwork.org.
Hi, it's John Bauermeister from the Green Radio Hour. Join us on Radio Kingston on Mondays at 6 p.m. for an hour of green conversations with environmentalists, thinkers, doers, activists, and our elected leaders.
Our government can say, oh, we tried everything and it didn't work out. You know, no, we have not tried everything. We have not tried rapidly building publicly owned renewables.
Legislation to essentially block turning the Hudson River into what would be effectively a parking lot.
The war machine and how it's so much capital is going into that, and no capital is going into actually righting the climate wrongs that have been done.
This is a food that's a better fuel source for you, the planet, and other animals. You know, people say they love animals, but, you know, they love them with ketchup and soy sauce.
That's the Green Radio Hour, Mondays from 6 to 7 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 107.9, and anytime at RadioKingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we're having a great conversation today with Dr. Zion Kloss. Zion is a professor of environmental science at Marist University, and also, though, is an outdoor adventurer and an incredible communicator, and provides tons of opportunities for young people and students to get outside and have, you know, meaningful and memorable relationships directly with the natural world. We've just got a few minutes left on the program, and I thought I would ask you, Zion, to talk a little bit. You mentioned in passing that you're on the board of a number of organizations that are across the valley. I know you mentioned the Fallkill Watershed Coalition, and, you know, I've just, one of the things that has made this show possible is this incredible network we have here in the Hudson Valley, is of all these scientists and conservationists and people who are working together across organizations, across institutions, to collaborate on things like the climate crisis and conservation. And so I just wondered if you could maybe speak a little bit to that ecosystem and how that works.
Yeah. Very briefly, I mean, it's an amazing ecosystem we have here. I've worked and lived all over the United States and internationally, and worked with community groups in all places. And we have such a high density here. I mean, it was really the birth of the environmental movement in a lot of ways back in the 1960s and 70s that was happening here in the Hudson Valley. And we are so fortunate, and it's been so great for my students at Marist University to have access to all these organizations and all these projects that can be tied with organization and community needs and what they're doing for their research projects. So the Hudson River Environmental Society is one of the oldest, and I serve on their board. And we do an annual conference every year, every fall, that brings together all the environmental professionals that are kind of want to know the latest and greatest research and updated science on what's happening in the Hudson River watershed. There's the Hudson River Watershed Alliance, which helps watershed groups and organizations coordinate and kind of get the latest and greatest ways that you can better protect your local watersheds. We have Scenic Hudson. I serve on their science advisory board. Massive, you know, protector of lands across the Hudson Valley, and they have so much open space. It's open to the public, so highly recommend going on their website and looking for all the great places to go hiking around here, and getting out in nature. And then we also have these smaller coalitions like the Fallkill Watershed Coalition that I help organize. So group, kind of community by community, we're helping really figure out how do we, because watersheds and hydrology is so exciting because it's an integrator, and watersheds are a perfect example of that because it's four different municipalities that have the same stream going through them. And so the decisions that one make are going to directly influence the other, and that's why watershed coalitions and groups are such a big thing that are kind of operate outside of these municipal spaces, because these watersheds don't care about our boundaries that we've put on the ground. They do their own thing out there in nature. And so these organizations have been a great resource for me and my students to be able to actually make our research super community relevant and decide what projects to do based on what the needs are coming out of these organizations.
Wow, that's so great. Yeah, we're really fortunate for that. With the last just minute that we have, I really want to encourage folks to, as we're getting into the warm months, if you have kids, think about some of the outdoor experiences. And we had Wild Earth on a couple weeks ago, and they do summer camps for kids. And there's a lot of other opportunities out there. But with that, I want to say thanks so much, Zion, for all the amazing work that you do and for taking time on your Saturday morning to come on the air.
It was great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Take care.
Myself to you completely.